Sticky Bird here from Chopped Tees. Our summer super sale is now on. Grab up to 25% off selected tees and hats from Post Wrestling, WrestleNomics, The Lapsed Fan, Poison Rana, and more. Shipping is free and fast almost everywhere in the world. Just go to chopped-tees.com and grab a deal before the sale ends at midnight, July 7th.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our Forbidden Door review. I am John Pollock, alongside Wei Ting. And Wei, 10 minutes in, happy Canada Day.
That is correct. Yes, July the 1st. It is Monday right now as we're recording this.
It's Monday. I was pretty confident we would not be starting the show until Monday, and here we are.
Yeah, happy July. First day of July.
Yes, yes. So what did you think of Serpentico?
Better luck next time for him, I think.
Yes. One of the late additions to the show that we got on the 0 hour. There was almost zero talking on the 0 hour. That panel got their good 15 minutes in, and then boom, we were off to the matches.
Yeah. This is, I think, the most in-ring content we've ever had for a 0 hour. And at this point, it's clearly Tony Khan's preference. I mean, I don't think any sort of criticism of there being too much is something that he cares to, or at least he agrees with, I would say.
Well, we're going to get into all of this from the UBS Arena on Sunday on Long Island. The final number from WrestleTix was 10,184. Earlier this week, Tony Khan had stated they were on target to hit a million-dollar gate, so we will see if they disclose whether they officially hit the million-dollar figure or not, but topping 10,000 people, that was a very, very good number for AEW, and I think that overall there was a lot of interest, in particular in the main event with this crowd that certainly treated this like the main event. I think they were more into that match than anything else. You could just tell from the reactions to the entrances and the bell ringing, like that was the clear cut number one match on this card.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe compared to some prior Forbidden Doors were, or even like just, I would say New Japan and even like ROH co-promoted shows, there might've sometimes been some dispute about like which match should be headlining. There was no dispute, I think, among anybody for this particular show. This was, at least on TV, the most heavily promoted match, it felt like. And I think in terms of stature and excitement from among the audience, this seemed to be the one with the most attached to it as well.
And we can talk about this off the top. They are going to take this format and New Japan will promote a second night at the Tokyo Dome on January 5th. This will be in addition to Wrestle Kingdom 19, so they will run the Tokyo Dome on back-to-back nights, and the second night will be promoted as Wrestle Dynasty and feature New Japan, AEW, CMLL, ROH, and Stardom talent. So, in essence, you're taking the concept of Forbidden Door and exporting it to Japan. This would be a New Japan run show, and it is a Saturday Sunday combo this January 4th and 5th, so typically that will favor New Japan's ability, but it is a return to back-to-back nights at the Tokyo Dome, which a few years ago they realized we did not have the demand for two nights, but they will attempt that in 2025.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, I think a lot of audiences have been asking, are we going to get a Japanese equivalent of Forbidden Door at any point? And sure enough, they booked the biggest building you could possibly book in Japan in order to do something like it. I think it's a major hook for international audiences who might at this point be lapsed fans of New Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, considering, I would say, I think the quality of Forbidden Door and the quality of like the talent you have to choose from with all of these promotions band together, it might even be the type of thing that might attract international travelers to consider going to Japan for one of these double headers again. You know, you're getting a culmination of your New Japan Pro Wrestling stories on that first night, and the second night you're getting a Forbidden Door type of event in the Tokyo Dome. So I think it's a great idea. I find it interesting that they felt this was big enough to attempt, and instead of like doing something with the what do they call it, the United Japanese Wrestling conglomeration,
the 9 promotions that are doing their fundraising shows together this year.
Yeah, like those that sort of like entity isn't running a Tokyo Dome, but they felt like you know, an AEW CMLL and Stardom co-promoted event is capable of doing it. And when you just look at the star power like represented on tonight's roster, for instance, I'm already very much looking forward to seeing what they come up with.
Well, let's get into it. There was a lot to break down on this show. The 0 Hour panel, it did feature Renee, Jeff Jarrett, Rocky Romero, and RJ City. And Daddy Ass explained to the Acclaimed he was staying in the back tonight. Although, don't worry, you would still get your Billy Gunn quotient on this card. Castor says that Tanahashi is better than Okada, and Okada's wife is more famous than Okada. So who's the bitch? And that was his first bitch of the night. And then Bowens said that they're going to send Okada crying to his $700 studio apartment in New York.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is a legitimate thing. He lives in New York, from what I hear. And
where is he living in New York City for $700 a month?
Did he say 700 or 700,000?
I thought I heard 700, though.
700,000 would actually be really cheap for New York.
Yeah, so that's what I'm stating, if he owns.
700. Okay, yeah.
I thought I heard 700, but I could have been mistaken.
Maybe he's staying in a hostel.
Well, dude, like $700, you're basically in a, that you, like, you could rent out a shower and sleep in there in New York City. I mean,
he's got roommates, clearly.
Maybe he's like right by Central Perk. I don't know. So basically by 6:45, we were getting right to the matches, and we get a bonus match between now former ROH TV champion Kyle Fletcher and Serpentico. Fletcher lost. They explained how he lost his ROH title match to Mark Briscoe on Thursday's ROH episode, and then dropped the TV title to Atlantis Jr. on Friday night at Arena Mexico. So Fletcher tears at the mask, hits a series of drop kicks and a tombstone, but won't go for the cover, so instead hits a brainbuster on top of the turnbuckle and wins in 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quite the spot for our bonus 3-minute opener on the 0 Hour.
Yeah. I mean, a 3-minute match with entrances, again, I think it just maybe more speaks to Tony Khan's clear philosophy of wanting to just, at this point, overload the 0 Hour with in-ring content rather than, you know, a talking panel. And I don't think that's going to change, you know, at this point. I'm reminded that, like, these aren't matches that a lot of people are required to watch. You and I are the exception. Maybe the most diehard of diehards are the exception. But, you know, for a lot of people, they're choosing to skip these. And this is certainly a match you could skip. Maybe a bit of added focus for Kyle Fletcher, who I think has been doing really well as a single star with a meaner edge. You completely see a future champion in him. And it looks to me like they're already, you know, beginning the push towards that future direction by really emphasizing his relationship with Will Ospreay. So it does make me wonder, whenever Mark Davis is back, like, do we see Aussie Open anymore? Because I see, unfortunately, way more upside to, you know, a Kyle Fletcher singles run right now.
Aussie closed.
Very, yes, yes.
Kyle Fletcher would also bookend this 5+ hour show as well. It'd be the first match, and he'd be there right at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Malachi Black and Brody King against Private Party, Roderick Strong and Gabe Kidd, who had Ghetto in their corner, and Tomohiro Ishii and Kyle O'Reilly. And Matt Menard stating the obvious, it's going to be a long night. And Ishii waves in Brody King. The crowd is buzzing for this interaction. Strong is giving Kyle O'Reilly a look as they are on opposite sides. Strong and Kidd are arguing as they take turns with Kyle. They start shoving one another, the partners do, and this allows O'Reilly to make it to his partner and tag Ishii. And Kyle O'Reilly and Ishii decided, you know what? Let's do Chasing the Dragon. Okay, Ishii, can you get Brody King up? Yeah, let's pick the biggest guy with Ishii lifting him. And what proceeded was Ishii nearly crippling this man, because this was the scariest looking brainbuster. As Brody King came down, and I thought this guy was not getting up. It was a frightening Chasing the Dragon. Kid,
I think they caught the dragon.
They caught it and then some. Brody King was alive. So that was a positive. Mm-hmm. Kid comes in with his own brainbuster to Ishii, but then Private Party hit a pair of dives. The silly string gets stopped by Brody King as they send Cassidy into the air as Malakai nails him with a knee and hits the end onto Quinn, followed by a lariat and Gonzo bomb. Isaiah Cassidy eats the fall at 8:35 as the Hoofs of Black go over.
I thought this was an excellent match for, you know, good quality in-ring action, big spots one after the other, like the type of match you could really just kind of sit back and not think so much about, like, storyline implications for. The Kyle Roddy stuff seems to be, like, the big story stuff coming out of this, but even that is just, like, whatever. Like, I'm not I don't care that much about it, I find.
The house always wins. That's the story.
I guess so. Stephen Watts says the pre-show is for when you have to vacuum your living quarter. Would you agree that this was a good match to have on while vacuuming?
I mean, people treat this as like you could watch something else if you're not so inclined to watch this. As we say, you're not obligated to watch any of this. I mean, this was a fine match. I enjoyed this for the
if you
8
chose
minutes that
they to had. Pay attention to it, and certainly maybe if you chose to even buy a ticket for it, I think you would have been grateful to see this one. You know,
Kyle Fletcher and Serpentico were there as a signal to the audience: quick, get to your seat. That was what that match was for. Sure. Oh, the wrestling's starting now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have 3 minutes to get to your seat, and then the rest of the matches we advertised are starting.
Yeah.
Mariah May, accompanied by Toni Storm and Luther, takes on Saraya, who had Harley Cameron in her corner, this being the opening round match of the Owen Hart Cup. And the winner will face Hikaru Shida, who advanced.
The Stardom match was for this one.
Did I skip over? Sorry. Chris Statlander and Momo Watanabe versus Willow Nightingale and Tam Nakano. So Stokely Hathaway is in the corner with Statlander and is distracting, which allows Statlander to suplex Nakano behind the back of the referee. So the heels are in control. Statlander then yanks Willow off the apron, preventing a tag, and then lands a head kick on Statlander, finally tagging in Willow, who just goes to town on Statlander. Nakano hits a bridging German and then a tiger suplex onto Momo. There's an avalanche DDT by Willow onto Momo for a big near fall, and then the Babe with the powerbomb is blocked. We see Momo in with a B driver for a two count, and then Momo's hit with the pounce. Clothesline Statlander out of the ring, and Nakano is the one to secure the win after hitting the Twilight Dream onto Momo Watanabe at 10 minutes and 19 seconds. I thought these four worked really well, and this was an audience that they did not seem as though they were unfamiliar with the Stardom talent, and you had the natural pairing here of Statlander and Willow that they gave you enough, and that was the interaction everyone wanted to see, but leaving you wanting more for this week when they do the match.
Yeah, I thought it was really good promotion for the Willow versus Statlander match coming up on Wednesday. I think they looked great in this match. Willow in particular, I thought, had some really good hard hitting offense. She's powerful and charismatic as hell. And I think Statlander actually like is very much the same type of wrestler. So the two of them opposing each other in this match in both of their hometowns of Long Island, I thought felt a bit special. I thought Tam Nakano and Momo Watanabe looked good, but I don't know if either made a big enough impression on this performance alone to me. And if I was like a novice fan who was just experiencing these two for the first time, I wouldn't necessarily say like either of them really stood out. But you know, like for the Forbidden Door aspect of it, I think, you know, happy to see them on here.
Then we go to the Owen Hart Cup match with Mariah May against Saraya. And Storm is out wearing a Stardom tracksuit as she is getting prepared for her match later in the show. And there is a handstand Rana off the top of the buckle by Mariah May, follows with a missile drop kick and goes to the hip attack, but Saraya avoids that. So they're trading strikes on the apron when Saraya yanks her by the hair into the post. And Excalibur reminds us that people are still filing in, which is usually code for there's not a lot of heat for this match, which there was not. There were ups and downs on this card. There were certainly the matches that the crowd was not as amplified for. Saraya's in control when May is firing off punches, lands the hip attack as Harley Cameron gets onto the apron, but is pulled off by Storm, and Saraya capitalizes with a super kick, gets a near fall, and then tries for the PTO, but is kicked off, and May blocks a suplex and turns it into a rolling cradle while bridging and catches Saraya in 8.5 minutes, and then Storm celebrates with May, and Mina Shirakawa also comes out to celebrate, so May has to get between Mina and Toni Storm and we would get the conclusion to this triangle later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the inclusion of this Owen Hart Foundation match on the 0 Hour, I think, like, ultimately helped, you know, tee up the Mina Shirakawa versus Toni Storm match on the pay-per-view pretty decently well, which for a 0 Hour meant to get people to buy the pay-per-view afterwards, I thought was actually, like, a good inclusion. Match itself for me didn't do a whole lot in terms of, like, flow or action, but despite that, I thought May continued to look really good in her, the execution of her offense. I thought the finish rolling bridge counter to Soraya's DDT looked really good. More on this storyline a bit later on.
Yota Tsuji, Hiromu Takahashi, and Titan against Mystico and the Lucha Brothers concluded the 0 Hour, and the announcers are noting the significance of this match and the complications of putting it together without actually explaining all of the politics. But I guess if you know, you know. And the crowd's chanting holy shit at this as well. This was obviously the standout match on the 0 Hour.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was presented as such, you know, in terms of star power, in terms of really like when you really speak about the Forbidden Door, I think the inclusion of talents that were at least, you know, at one time very closely associated with AAA on this show really is sort of the most Forbidden Door of ness of the entire event at this point. The crowd treated this like it was that big of a deal.
So they build up to Mystico and Hiromu being tagged in together, and Hiromu goes for Mystico's mask and gets attacked by Tsuji and Titan, so the Lucha Brothers hit double super kicks. Tsuji and Titan then hit dives to the floor, and Hiromu executes a sunset bomb to Mystico to the floor. There's a running PK by Phoenix as he runs the top rope onto Titan, and then a springboard off the shoulders of Penta for a splash, which leads to a two count. Penta comes in with a destroyer on Hiromu, and they hit him with a series of super kicks. All six are down as the fans are cheering, and we get the fear factor with the assisted stomp from Phoenix onto Hiromu, but then rolls out, and it's Mystico in the ring with Titan with La Mystica for the win in 12 minutes, and I thought this was an excellent way to end the show, and I think that this was the one that had the most audience engagement of these five matches. By
to end the pre-show, you mean, because we still had the show a lot.
Well, this is 0 Hour. This is its own self-contained show. Oh. For some people, this is their WWE pay-per-view. They got their five matches, and they're good for the month.
That's true.
Got my 90 minutes.
What a match, you know, like I would say most shows around the world, like this would have been a match of the night. This would have been an incredibly worthy main event, but on this card, it is a kickoff match. The one I would never complain about. I saw some people say like they wish this was on the actual pay-per-view. I mean, whatever. Like this was your calling card for to
why?
Get people.
Like what? Yeah. What's the logic of I wish I had to pay for this?
Because there's a pecking order in people's minds in terms of prestige of like, you know, matches that are on a pay-per-view versus matches that are on prelims. Certainly like UFC audiences kind of go through this as well. But I you can argue the main event of the prelims is more important than a typical match on the pay-per-view because
like this isn't an indictment of this story between like this is just a cool match to put together, so I don't know why I would care where this was on the show. This is not like I don't know. I was really happy with its placement. Got 12 minutes. I was very happy with this.
I thought the Lucha Brothers were amazing here. It's just cool to see the Lucha Brothers on these pay-per-views. You know, they are like two of the best wrestlers in AEW, and their sort of exclusion in this sort what feels like an all-star game of these rosters has always felt like a big omission. But I thought Titan stole the show here.
He was great.
Despite taking the pin, I thought this dude looked amazing, especially when he was in there with Phoenix at the beginning. That was an incredible pairing. So this was a great crossover match and showcase of what adding CMLL to this mix has brought to this year's Forbidden Door.
Well, it was, having to cross a lot of borders to be able to bring this card together as AEW brought in CMLL, New Japan, and Stardom talent. And it was as though you had a seamless transition way from the U.S. to Mexico to Japan. But Tony Khan is not the first one to do such a thing. Let us remind you about NordVPN.
As wrestling fans, we now have access to more events than ever before. But with rising ticket and travel costs, subscription fees, and a growing number of pay-per-views, staying up to date can get expensive, which is why we love telling our audience about NordVPN. In the US, ordering Forbidden Door will cost you $50, but directing your NordVPN to the UK or Australia immediately unlocks cheaper international prices, allowing you to purchase the event at half the price. Using NordVPN, you can also sign up for AEW Plus, which grants you an even bigger discount on AEW's pay-per-views and access to editions of Dynamite, Rampage, and Collision Live or On Demand, commercial-free. Nord continues to give post-wrestling listeners an exclusive offer of 4 bonus months on top of all 2-year plans when you sign up at nordvpn.com/postwrestling. That's less than $3 a month for their basic plan. And just for this period, they're sweetening the deal with global eSIM service Saily, offering up to 20 gigabytes of travel data available for use in over 150 countries. Sign up at nordvpn.com/postwrestling to get your bonus months and free Saily data voucher, 30-day money-back guarantee if you're not satisfied. Again, nordvpn.com/postwrestling. Let Nord know you found them through us.
Excellent, excellent one. That 9 out of 10, John.
That was a good one. Yeah. Way gives me an automatic 8 out of 10 if I just remember it, and then the creativity gets me an extra point. Sure. So we go into the main show, which featured Excalibur, Taz, and Nigel McGuinness, and Tony Schiavone absent because the man lost his voice during Wednesday's Dynamite, and we have literally not heard from him since. So he missed the broadcast, and hopefully he's doing better. Hopefully he's back at TV this week.
I certainly hope he's healthy. I mean, for somebody of his position, a voice is very important, obviously. But I'd be lying if I said I wasn't ecstatic that Nigel got the call this entire show. I thought he was fantastic. I thought he and Taz together were actually really fun to listen to. They played off of each other really well.
That was the team for the whole night. And then the last two matches, they inserted Jim Ross, who I thought was very good. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would say was that I did think 4 people was too many. And they were even almost like joking about it at sometimes, like, hey, Taz, are you still here? But it's tough. Like we talk about 3-man booths are tough. 4 is that much more. But I thought I did like having Jim Ross in those matches. And I thought Jim Ross really brought it for those 2 matches.
And remember Jim Ross battling recent health issues.
He was in the emergency room, having to make the trip and such. So we had Justin Roberts and Takuro Shibata. So we had the co-ring announcers for the evening. And kicking things off, was not too surprised they put this one in the opener. It was Hechicero and MJF. And as you can imagine, MJF getting a thunderous reaction on Long Island, and he comes out in the colors of the New York Islanders and goes to crowd surf as he is walking down. And Nigel and the announcers, like, they are effectively pushing the story that we got based on MJF's comments on Wednesday that MJF could be overlooking Hechicero. He's not taking him seriously. So in the early portion of the match, we see MJF doing the different, you know, the Fargo strut, the Rick Rude and Savage mannerisms, and then runs Hechicero into the guardrail and starts posing to the crowd when he gets his arm snapped on the top rope. And this was the focus of Hechicero, going after the previously injured arm and shoulder of MJF. So Hechicero, who I thought showed a ton of charisma in this environment where he mocks MJF doing the strut and then gives the crowd the middle fingers, and he got a ton of heat for this. So I thought he really did well in a role that was not exactly set up for him to be, like, he was basically the opponent of the hometown guy.
Some sign language exhibited by some of the international talent tonight. Mm-hmm.
Then Hechicero pretty much busted out like a reverse elevator sweep into an armbar. And then MJF is countering it to a Fujiwara, and Hechicero escapes that and crucifixes the arms of MJF, who reaches the rope. MJF does the 10 punches in the corner, bites him, and then, as a nod to his former best friend, hits the Long Island Sunrise and the Brainbuster for the win in 9 minutes and 49 seconds. Afterward, MJF tweeted, "Easy dub, grab some ice, hit the pay window, bagel boss time." And that ends the MJF Hechicero chapter of AEW. And I have got to say that I was kind of confused when they went this direction for the pay-per-view. I thought that the promo on Wednesday was more curious. And now that we're done, this was a way to have MJF in his hometown and got a win. And that was it. Match was fine, but it was just a very bizarre handling of arguably your number 2 star maybe 3-star in the company. And I think many would say number 1-star in the company.
So now you could argue number 1, just maybe given the crowd, right? Yeah. I think we're not the only ones to question why this match was made for MJF in his hometown on a pay-per-view. But I think the thing that we were all expecting, you know, coming out of the pay-per-view was for all of us to say, what a great match that was, you know, maybe even justified, you know, why this match occurred. This was a very good match. You know, like you mentioned, John, I thought Hechicero had a great showcase, but it wasn't at the level that I think it needed to be to convince maybe doubters like ourselves that this belonged on this show and that this was the right match for MJF in Long Island on this particular show. It was a very strong match by really kind of any metric, but we have different expectations for MJF in Long Island on pay-per-view.
On this card, I'm not going to go so far as to say it was a strong match. Like okay. It was good.
Sure.
But it got a great reaction because MJF was there. They did some cool stuff. It was like a fine opener. But again, I just see MJF in his, you know, he's still fresh since coming back. And this is his hometown. Hey, to that end, though, they ended up surpassing 10,000 people. And I do credit like MJF being on this show as a reason for, you know, the show doing what it did. So you want to have him on this card. I just think,
of course you want to have him on this card. That's not the question. The question is, do you want to give those 10,000 people a match that they've dreamt about MJF having, or a match that is going to be good but not necessarily a dream match caliber type of match, right? I will say, maybe coming out of this, maybe the tweet aside, you know, which would be, I guess, could be bluffing, is that MJF might be leaving this with an arm injury that he could, you know, take into a further storyline.
So the cloud of Hechicero looms over MJF this summer.
Mm-hmm. It's the build to Wembley. Yeah.
Kazuchika Okada and the Young Bucks against Hiroshi Tanahashi and the Acclaimed. Man, Okada, you would think, is like the most, after MJF on this show, it's like he got almost as big a reaction as MJF coming out here. Superstar babyface reaction for heel Okada coming out here with the Bucks. And Max does his rap. He's going to leave them out of breath like Biden at the podium, making fun of Justin Timberlake's mugshot. And then we're going to kill you like you guys killed Okada's career. And then proceeded to drop bitch after bitch after bitch after bitch after bitch.
Yeah,
technically rhyme, but we got multiple bitches out to the point I'm wondering if Max Caster is a regular listener of ours.
Really abusing the bitch button there. Yeah. This also followed a video package for the Bucks that was sort of done, you know, like in a like commission, you know, by them. So it was very much a pro Bucks, and they specifically blurred out Kenny Omega from any other old New Japan Pro Wrestling Elite footage.
I guess it's worth noting as well, on Collision, they did air the Hangman Page vignette. So they are teasing his return, whether that leads into the wild card or the wild card is like that's designed to be a kind of misdirection. But that wild card will be revealed on Wednesday.
Specifically targeting Swerve and replaying a lot of the home invasion.
Yeah, the home invasion, and he's gone back to drinking. So Okada and Tanahashi, they tease going at it. And I mean, this crowd, they wanted to see Okada and Tanahashi, and Okada tags out, so the crowd's upset. They want to see those two. There's the Scissor Me Timbers onto Matt and Nick, and then they scissor and play the air guitar. And then we get the spot when Nick takes the headphones of Max and puts them on, and Okada starts, what would we call this, air scratching?
Air scratching, air like sort of like stereotypical sort of rapper hand gestures, I suppose.
Listen, we have a great main event to talk about, but the legacy of this show is going to be this gif.
I can't pull it up, but
unfortunately, yes. this was a great moment that again will be wonderful when they finally turn Okada babyface at some point.
Oh my god, he's doing such a great job of, like, I mean, yes, he's made a name for himself as being one of the greatest wrestlers in the world, but he's really I think getting people talking and retweeting based off of how funny he is.
The Acclaimed get the advantage. They hit the arrival and the mic drop onto Okada. And then Tanahashi climbs to the top for the high fly flow, but the Bucks grab him by the legs. So the Acclaimed take out the Bucks. Tanahashi goes for the high fly flow, but Okada's had enough time to recover, so he gets the knees up. The Bucks return, they pump up their Reeboks and super kick the Acclaimed, then Tanahashi, and Okada lands the elbow, goes for the Rainmaker pose, but instead of the pose, it's the middle fingers. You know, he was taking notes watching Hechicero. It's like, he knows the way to the hatred of these fans. And instead of the Rainmaker, Tanahashi counters with an inside cradle for a two count. He fights off the Young Bucks, and then as he's running the ropes for the Sling Blade, he's hit with the drop kick by Okada and a Rainmaker, and Tanahashi, there, the company president, the company man, takes the pin as Okada pins Tanahashi in 13:01.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In another world where, like, maybe Okada successfully, or WWE successfully negotiated with Okada, it does make me wonder how different that run would have been from this current run. Like, would WWE Okada be calling people bitch and, like, pulling out middle fingers instead of the Rainmaker? Something tells me he wouldn't, and that they would be presenting him in a very different way. So
maybe he'd be laid out backstage by the Wyatt Six.
He'd probably be in the Wyatt Six.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he can wear the pig mask, I think. Yeah, this was a fun
because he's done so well under masks in U.S.-based companies.
That is
in the
correct.
Past.
This was a fun match that I think did a very good job of, like, you know, using the Okada Tanahashi rivalry as its sort of main source of attraction on the show. Okada, as always throughout this AEW run, has been a lot of fun to watch as a heel character. Tanahashi is very clearly incredibly limited in mobility. Like, there was that one time in this match where he had to run across the ring to chase Okada on the apron, mm-hmm. and it looked like a pirate, like, with a peg leg walking along the deck. But despite that, like, he garners a lot of respect and is still seen as a big star by this crowd, and I think that was more than enough, you know. So it was a worthwhile show on this for sure, just for the Okada Tanahashi interaction.
Yeah, and then afterwards Okada goes for another Rainmaker on Tanahashi, and there to save the day is Daddy Ass, who runs down, and we get Okada cowering in fear, running away from Daddy Ass on the Forbidden Door show. I can only imagine that they will be so brazen as to do a Okada Billy Gunn match on TV.
Why wouldn't
kind of what this led to at the end? Like, you were left to think that it was like, it was mm-hmm. Billy Gunn saving the others that are a third of his age.
Sure.
Or at least half his age. Mm-hmm. Shingo Takagi and Bryan Danielson is third on the pay-per-view in the Owen Hart Cup. And Nigel asks, why is Bryan considered the best wrestler in the world? And he compares his lack of achievements at 43 to what Napoleon had done at 40 and what Mozart had done at 30. Which I guess were all valid points. Danielson not only has all the kinesio tape on his neck, but he's got the cupping marks as well. And they're explaining this is all the remnants of that Tiger Driver. So,
So they're doing the selling of the Tiger Driver for him, which is
yes,
cool. Yeah,
yep. I mean, they are keeping that as like this plague on Bryan Danielson. Uh-huh. So this is a rematch from Dragon Gate USA, Enter the Dragon, which I decided to watch yesterday as a primer for this. Different matches, but I mean, still, it was, you know, we're talking 14 years apart. And a lot of, I would say, of all the matches on this show, this one maybe had the highest of expectations.
For me, it was the main event as well, but this was definitely up there. I'm curious to know which match you thought was better by the end of this. I meant between their 14-year difference, these two.
Between the Dragon Gate USA match and this mm-hmm. match?
Yeah.
I'd go with the Dragon Gate USA match.
Ooh, okay.
Yes.
So people don't
It's just different. Like, they're doing a whole lot different stuff. This one was so contingent on, you know, heavy, very, very believable strikes and a ton of, like, great selling, in particular of Danielson and his neck, and just eliciting a lot of sympathy against this, like, this machine that would just not slow down, and Danielson having to kind of fight his game, as opposed to, it was just like all these crazy athletic maneuvers that they're doing when they're each 14 years younger. So they're very different matches, but I think both very positive in their respective rights. So early on, Danielson goes for a suicide dive and is caught and gets draped on the edge and immediately is hit with a neck breaker. And Doc Samson is checking on him, but he's able to beat the count and he's just selling and selling. He battles back, and Takagi throughout the match is doing the yes mannerism to the crowd, and the crowd would chant no in response. So Danielson slides, knocks him off balance, and does a back suplex off of the buckle, and Danielson is kicking away at the arm, stopping the lariats, and goes for a triangle because he's not going to be able to win the striking battle, but he has his submission game. So Takagi lifts, slams his way free, and then Takagi hits a superplex and a sliding D. Danielson then misses a drop kick in the corner and is hit with an inside-out lariat and the Made in Japan for a two count. Danielson is then going to his knees. He tries to fight back, ducks a sliding D, and turns the wrist into the lebel lock, but it's stopped by Takagi. And he starts putting his arms in the air, pointing up as he lands the Busaiku knee for an excellent near fall, starts stomping Takagi's head, and then applies the triangle, is landing elbows, and is lifted, but this time he's all ready for the attempt to slam out, and he counters with more elbows and in midair transitions to a Fujiwara armbar and just wrenches back as Aubrey Edwards goes and calls it at 20 minutes, and it was a stoppage that they ended up going with here, right at 20 minutes, and afterward, the two showing mutual respect as Takagi leaves the loser, and Danielson advances to face Pac on Wednesday. Mm-hmm.
A stoppage with I guess the announcer speculating that there was some sort of verbal
submission. Yeah.
Even though he had an arm free, I guess. Well, whatever. Like, he did not dispute the finish here, Shingo Takagi. So I do love the unusual use of just like a straight up, you know, Fujiwara belly down armbar instead of like the usual lebel lock. And it just kind of, to me, feels sometimes a bit more realistic to have a move that is more fitting of the story and of the moment rather than just resorting to like your sort of trained finishing move, because not every move is perfect for every application. I thought the match was great. Yeah, both men had just such great clean technique, and it was very hard hitting with some brilliant counters designed and with great execution. I thought Shingo here, like, kind of unexpected, but like Shingo received a bit more of a heelish reaction than I think like he was anticipating, or at least I was anticipating. I thought this would be like a very full-on double babyface match, but I thought Shingo made some good use of some easy heel tactics, like mocking the yes chant to get a reaction out of this crowd. So it certainly felt like a match between like two of the very best wrestlers in the world, with Brian really still showing that he's at the very top of his game. But maybe you would disagree with that.
Well, I mean, I'm comparing with 2010 Brian Danielson. He's evolved and changed his game very much. I thought this was really solid. It was not my match of the show, but it was still maybe number two or number three on the show. And I guess that would come down, like, these two are guilty of everyone's expectations that were huge for this match. When people are talking about, is this going to be a match of the year? Like, it's very hard when that's the expectation level going in. But I did think this was certainly one of the better matches on the show, that there were matches that were hit and there were some that were misses.
Yeah, I will say it was sort of around this point, and especially maybe afterwards in the next match, where I definitely sensed the crowd dipping in terms of energy levels. And I don't know if you'd agree, but
they certainly did. Some by, like, in the case of like the Zack Sabre Jr. Orange Cassidy match, it was like, the crowd was not that engaged, but I almost felt it was like, it was not like they were not interested. It was just like, given like the grappling and such that they were doing, like, this was not tailored for, those big crowd moments that certain other matches were. But definitely this crowd took a dip. And could you argue that maybe Danielson and Shingo was too early on the show?
Too early.
In that this was one of the big matches that people were looking forward to, and you had like seven matches to go after this.
I think this part of the show needed like one of your semi-main events, you know, one of your most anticipated matches. And I think that probably helped the later matches get a more energized crowd. So I didn't really dislike this. I would maybe argue about the placement of a match like Zach versus Orange, though. That was very much more like ground-based.
Before that, it's Timeless Toni Storm and Mina Shirakawa for the AEW Women's Championship, where Mariah May is in the ring to present flowers to both in preparation for the title match. And Toni Storm, first Mina Shirakawa comes out and does the whole Club Venus dance, and then Toni Storm does her entrance dressed as the Statue of Liberty.
this was outstanding.
Man, was this better than Shinsuke's?
No, it was not actually. Nakamura's is better, but very close. You know, takes a lot of confidence to pull off the Statue of Liberty. But I thought she looked great here. I think Shirakawa's entrance somehow translates like really well to North American television. Both of them, I thought, like, contributed to like a very good big match feel at the beginning of this match.
There's chance for both when the match kicked off, and Mina goes after the knee of Storm, wrapping it around the post and then applying a figure four. And Storm catches her with a backstabber and goes for the hip attack, sending Mina to the floor, and then misses with a follow-up hip attack, and Storm goes into the stairs. So Mina hits a high cross onto Storm and Luther and goes back to working on the knee. She hits a DDT off the top turnbuckle and follows with an impaler, and then Storm stops the glamorous driver. So Storm recovers, hits the hip attack, and then Mina hits the glamorous collection for a two count, and then a glamorous driver leads to a near fall. Storm hits her with headbutts, ducks the hurricane, and then a released German leads to Storm Zero, and Storm wins in 11 minutes and 40 seconds. And May is conflicted. She doesn't know if she should celebrate or be consoling the loser. And before we get to the post-match, what did you think about this match? That was one of the better built matches that, you know, you, in the case of Mina Shirakawa, you were taking someone from scratch in the lead up to all of this, and has become one of the more over performers on this show. And I sense like just what they did here, that this was hardly a case of just putting these two on paper and throwing the match out.
No, not at all. Like, I'm just thinking back to maybe like a month or 2 months ago where like, I think we were complaining about the, like, we knew this would probably be the director for Forbidden Door, but the way they initially introduced Mina Shirakawa with these sort of like very random appearances on TV, coming out and just like making out with Mariah May, with the slight mention that, hey, they used to tag team together. Here's them making out without any other context behind it. I thought was, didn't get this thing off to a good start, but by the time the pay-per-view was in view and they really wanted to, I guess, tell a proper story with these two, boy did they make up for it. Because like I mentioned, John, you know, by the beginning of this match, this felt like one of the more anticipated matches on the entire show. And when you're talking about a combined roster with New Japan Pro Wrestling talent, let's just even say CMLL talent, for the argument's sake as well, to have somebody who really prior to this pay-per-view has not had any sort of significant appearances for AEW or North American television in general from Stardom be as a big of a sort of like draw, in my opinion, for this show as they have, tells me that Mina Shirakawa is somebody who they should completely, if they don't already, have their eye on to bring over permanently. It also tells me that Mariah May and Toni Storm did a fantastic job here, along with the people who are responsible in producing all of this in AEW, for telling, I think, a wonderful story with some great video packages and very good in-ring segments as well. The match itself had a lot of anticipation for it, and I did really enjoy the match, you know. Great action, both wrestle at a very high level, both really excel in terms of charisma as well. I did feel, though, in portions of this match, maybe especially towards the end, where I felt the crowd getting a bit tired towards it, they weren't as loud for the finish as I personally expected, but they were loud at other parts of the match.
So Mina offers her hand, and they end up shaking hands as May is in between them and encourages the two to hug, and they do. And then the three kiss simultaneously, I guess borrowing from Tommy Dreamer with Kimona and Beulah. And Nigel is seen standing and weeping as they have all come together, the three of them. So they leave all together as a unit.
Nigel standing.
Nigel had quite the night. Okay. Oh, this guy was auditioning to, if he's not wrestling, to at least be calling all in at Wembley.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. He's worked up a great shtick for himself. Well, like between the Danielson thing and like the sort of, fangirling over, Mariah May. I mean, he's been, I think, a great addition to the commentary team, but yeah, this sort of like ending tells me that Shirakawa is likely to stick around, if not on a permanent basis, then at least on an intermittent basis, where they will continue to revisit this faction.
Zack Sabre Jr. and Orange Cassidy. We had some jokes about Zack Sabre Jr. wearing orange since Taz is on commentary. And Nigel suggested, what if he called himself the British suplex machine? And Taz said, well, then there'd be a lawsuit if he called himself that.
Yes.
Early on, again, it's like a lot of like grappling counters and straitjacket reversals. Zach is getting frustrated that Orange is hanging with him. And then he torques the neck of Cassidy, and that would be his focus. Cassidy comes back with a dragon screw on the floor, so he's targeting the knee. And Cassidy ends up hitting his own version of the Zach driver, a diving DDT off of the top for a two count. And when he hit this DDT off of the top, man, Zach came down and spiked himself like you used to see Rob Van Dam take these DDTs.
Like Brody King.
Oh, my goodness. It was like he just came down at a straight angle onto the mat. Zach catches the orange punch, stomps the elbow, and then snaps the fingers. And this would play a factor in the rest of the match, where the orange punch would not be as effective when he was going for a submission with the Texas Cloverleaf. He couldn't grip his hands because he was selling the fingers. And then Zach again attacks the fingers. The beach break is hit out of nowhere, but Zach kicks out. The orange punch lands, but Zach is not out because the punch is not as effective with his hands injured. So Zach hits a PK, and then there's a European clutch by Zach, which is countered with Orange Cassidy using one of his own with the hands in the pockets. And the mousetrap is attempted by Orange, but it is countered as Zach ties up both his arms, then ties the legs all simultaneously to get a submission of Orange Cassidy at 16 minutes and 22 seconds. It did seem like there was probably like the last 6 or 7 minutes, the tempo goes up so dramatically. And I thought the final half of this was really, really strong stuff when they were just going at a crazy pace. And I did enjoy the element with the hand with Orange Cassidy. So I overall thought this was a very strong match by the end of it.
A very good match, I thought. You know, it was a really strong technical battle and a side of Orange Cassidy that I think is very understated, that we don't often see because he's such a character. You don't really think of him as, you know, somebody who could be showcased as a great technical wrestler capable of wrestling, you know, with a Zack Sabre Jr. in this sort of style. It reminds you that he is just behind the gimmick, an incredible wrestler who's very versatile as well. I would say perfect technical wrestling, some really cleverly designed sequences. I do think the placement of this match on a show of this sort of a density might have hurt it. The crowd, to me, in this match sounded tired but respectful because they knew the high level sort of like technical display that they were watching. This was 3 hours since the first match by this point, and like a 3 hour show to wrestling fans is like maybe not that much. But they pack these shows so dense of in-ring content and like high quality in-ring content, technical in-ring content, like we saw earlier in the night between Hedgesera and MJF, or even Danielson and Shingo. That by the time you get to this, without that much like build for this sort of story between Orange Cassidy and Zack Sabre Jr., it didn't feel that important to me. Like there certainly weren't any stakes attached to this particular match that I don't blame the crowd for maybe not being as up for this as I think you might expect given the high quality of the in-ring action.
Coming up this Friday, Rewind Away, we cover WrestleMania 9, clocking in at 2 hours and 47 minutes.
Oh, that well, hey, we could do it. We're allowed.
Then they confirmed that Grand Slam returning to Arthur Ashe Stadium Wednesday, September 25th, where they will do Dynamite and Collision. So another late night for the folks at Arthur Ashe Stadium. Those have been some long Wednesday nights. Samoa Joe, Hook, and Katsuyori Shibata against Chris Jericho, Big Bill, and Jeff Cobb. So I'm always interested now to see what the reaction is going to be for Jericho in particular. And in a market like New York, where, as we recall, the last pay-per-view they had here was the World's End show back in December. And that was the weekend when everything was going down with Jericho. And that was like it broke that weekend. So here we are 6 months later, and he comes out and there's definitely boos for Jericho. There's also cheers. And then when the match begins, loud chants of please retire. And Jericho gets onto the microphone and states that clearly you don't really mean you want me to retire because I'm from Long Island, as Taz explains that he was born in Manhasset, which was a upper class area of Long Island. So
Yeah.
What did you make of the reaction throughout the match and in terms of, you know, like the audience's reaction to the Learning Tree and the Jericho character himself?
At this point, I consider it to be a pretty typical Chris Jericho reaction. And I think I would argue like the type of reaction that he through the creation of this particular character of his would actually want. I think if you ask Chris Irvine, the performer, he would tell you that this is going exactly as he's planned and as intended. And him calling out the please retire chants is, I think, exactly his way of using, you know, those chants to further the character. So I think, you know, he's in AEW, I would say, are probably of the mind that a reaction is better than no reaction. And you can argue that it's working. I personally find it entertaining. Like I find him to be at least a memorable part of these shows and a pretty dynamic part of these shows, because you never really know what you're going to get from these crowds and how he's going to play with that reaction.
So Jericho is quick to tag out, and Joe and Cobb is the big showdown everyone wants to see. There's lots of boos when Jericho would enter, and then Hook gets jumped from behind by Cobb as Brian Keed distracts, and they're choking him on the rope as Aubrey's back is turned. Hook ends up tagging Shibata. They attack Cobb 3-on-1. Shibata gets the knees up on a lion salt, and then Bill sends Joe's shoulder into the rail, and Hook comes off the top with a double sledge to Bill on the floor. Keed distracts as Jericho hits Shibata with a low blow, applying the walls, but Shibata breaks out of it. So Bill is in with a choke slam on Joe, and we see a spin cycle on Shibata. Hook T-bones Jeff Cobb and then is hit with the code breaker for a two count, and then we see Hook lifted on the shoulders, and they we see the attempt to get the red rum onto Jericho, but he breaks free of that. Then Hook lands the Judas effect as Joe and Shibata have the others in chokes, and Hook pins Jericho in 14 minutes after executing the Judas effect onto him.
So Hook finally got his win over Jericho.
Yes.
In their feud that sort of turned into the Learning Tree. Yeah. Again, like up and down this card, when you have talent that's this strong, every match is going to be entertaining. Every match is going to be, I think, by most metrics of what we define a good match to be, it's going to fit that. I guess the question is more about whether or not it contributed to your overall enjoyment of this entire show. And while I thought this was a very entertaining match, I thought it would have been an even better match if it was safe for television and not placed on a 15-match card that didn't need to be 15 matches. I don't think like the story or like really any of these guys' presences on this show was adding that much value to a paying customer. And if this card excluded any of these performers, I don't know if many people would have complained about that. Cobb and Joe had some really great interactions. That's almost like a bit of a dream pairing. Big Bill, I think, works well as a big man. But maybe I kind of felt like Jeff Cobb was a bit more memorable than Big Bill in this particular match.
Yeah, this was one where I had a lot of the same thoughts as you. Like if I was going to say like excluding the 0 hour, like of these 10 matches, if there was like one too many on this card, this might fit the bill for you. And coming out of it, I mean, I don't know how much more you really need to do with Hook and Jericho beyond if Hook is going to go for this FTW title. But you also have this weird Shibata involvement as well after that video that I think at some point you have to do that match. But who knows when they're going to
go with Suzuki, that. You mean?
Sorry, with Minoru Suzuki.
Right. Yeah, I would expect Suzuki to fail at winning the FTW title. And I don't know, should Hook win the FTW title back? Like, what's that going to do for Hook? Really?
Maybe he just gives it as a present to Taz and it's forgotten about at that point. Like, he just wins it back, Taz gets the title, he can trademark FTW, and it's never seen again.
For now, there's value in it as sort of like a heat-generating item for Jericho, I suppose.
Maybe this is a title Jordan Grace can go for as well in another promotion.
That would be a wonderful way of tying in recent controversies, yes.
The ladder match followed with Mark Briscoe, Konosuke Takeshita, Dante Martin, El Phantasmo, Leo Rush, and Jack Perry in a match where I feel most of the audience was just hoping no one was going to die in this one. Perry comes out in the goat's mask, and they all go after Perry at the beginning, and Takeshita drills him with a forearm. Then they all gang up on Takeshita with the reasoning that he's the biggest guy in the match. Phantasmo takes Leo Rush with a UFO onto a ladder in the corner, and both crush the ladder. Briscoe does the Sandman spot with the ladder around his neck and then just dumps it onto Rush. And then Briscoe hits a springboard dive onto Takeshita on a table with a ladder on top. And Excalibur is theorizing that Takeshita's arm might be broken, which if Ghetto was booking the G1, would have had a heart attack, but he seemed to be fine.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Jack Perry and Phantasmo meet on the ladder, and Dante removes Perry, and the two get tripped, get tipped, as Dante grabs his leg in pain, and Excalibur's yelling, "Not again!" And so they did the tease that he re-broke his leg, but he was okay. Then they set up a ladder on the edge of the apron, and I was thinking, this is just the worst idea, whatever this is going to materialize into. And Leo Rush dives through the ladder onto Takeshita on the floor. Then Briscoe climbs this ladder on the edge of the apron, and he leaps across to the other side of the ring and comes up short where Jack Perry is set up on a table. And the way Mark Briscoe comes down, like Excalibur brought it up, and everyone's thinking of Adam Copeland, like he's going down, like he's plunging straight down. And I mean, this table did not break. He came up short. It was way too much distance to cover. Thankfully, I mean, he seemed fine afterward. I mean, I've said they seemed fine multiple times in this match. We will see if everyone was fine after this one, but this was another scary spot. Leo and Dante climb. They're both eyeing the title, but Takeshita returns with a last ride to Dante, then one to Leo Rush through a ladder. The fans just suddenly picked Takeshita as their favorite, and they wanted to see Takeshita win, so they're going nuts when he's climbing. And Phantasmo springs onto the ladder, and El Phantasmo is yanked off into a knee strike and then hit with it's Phantasmo with a pair of sudden death super kicks onto Takeshita. And we see Takeshita nearly hit with the CR2 on the edge, but he counters and hits a blue thunder bomb, sending El Phantasmo and him through these two tables on the floor that just explode upon impact. And it was like the crowd didn't even realize there were tables there. So when they got this explosion, it was that much bigger of a pop. So Takeshita climbs, Briscoe returns with a chair, and he's trying to bridge this ladder that's broken, and he's having a lot of trouble with it, so he just has to make do for this J-driller spot. And Perry then attacks Briscoe with a ladder and hits him with a chair multiple times, steps on top of Briscoe and climbs up to grab the belt in 16 minutes and 53 seconds. And I thought that was the logical person to go to, and I think you do have something here with Mark Briscoe and Jack Perry. And I mean, the revelation here was just how much this crowd wanted, like, Takeshita to win this and see him in that light, which would tell you that, you know, perhaps like his role in the Don Callis family has kind of run its course with people. But he's going to be gone all summer, so it's not necessarily
It might tell you that the Don Callis family has run its course, because there are several people in that similar position. Yeah, to me, like, I think the story of this match coming out of it was the very unexpected baby facing of Konosuke Takeshita by this crowd. I don't think they expected it, because the match was not structured to be like that. You had Mark Briscoe come in to stop a Takeshita title grab attempt, and Mark is sort of positioned as like one of the biggest baby faces in the entire match. But when you really think about it, it's really no surprise why Takeshita would be put in this position. He constantly like overperforms, I think, his win-loss record. You know, he's put in a position to always like give you a big anticipated matchup to showcase somebody that your AEW is actually trying to push. Meanwhile, he constantly loses. So this crowd got really excited at seeing the possibility of Takeshita finally getting crowned. And I think it tells AEW that it might be time to push him as a babyface whenever he comes back from the G1. The timing of it right now might not be great, because Ospreay and Fletcher are kind of doing a similar like baby babyface turn leaving the Don Callis family, but maybe after the G1 would be a good time to turn Takeshita, because this crowd certainly is ready for it. The rest of the match, I thought these six killed it. I thought this was an excellent ladder match, like that broke up the sort of style of matches throughout this night, gave you like some really good spectacle, hardcore ladder match type of stuff. Leo Rush, I think, is so great to see back in AEW, at least, you know, for the time being. He's such a unique talent, like among your top tier fastest wrestlers, I think, in the industry. Technically, he's so perfect. So he also took some of the biggest bumps in this particular match too. So I was really happy to see him. I thought they framed Perry really well here too, by having him pretty much like avoid most of the fan-friendly spots in this entire match. So by the time he actually won, you're like, oh, the guy who did the least won the match. So you probably want to hate him more. But the logical choice to win. Yeah.
Mercedes Moné and Stephanie Vaquer for the AEW Women's Championship and the Strong Women's Championship. And this is under AEW rules, they note at the beginning. So early on, we see Vaquer with her own European clutch, and Excalibur notes that borrowing from Zack Sabre Jr. And Taz points out, you know, he didn't invent that, you know. And then as she starts doing the Otani-style face wash in the corner, Nigel says, I wonder if Otani trademarked those. And Taz says, thanks, smartass.
They're hilarious.
Moné goes for the three amigos. The last one gets stopped. And Stephanie Vaquer then takes over until coming off the top and is hit with a dropkick. And the moneymaker is countered as Vaquer hits a DDT and then misses a follow-up leg drop. And there's a double underhook pile driver by Vaquer that gets blocked. And both go down off clotheslines. Vaquer gets her own crossface when Moné counters. And the crowd just starts booing Mercedes at this point. And Mercedes kicks off the rope with the crossface applied. It's the bank statement is unnamed. It's just the crossface. Maybe we need like a 10Q form or something like that, a SEC filing, something like that.
They could workshop it. Yeah, I don't know about those ones, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, at this point, the crowd is just all for Stephanie Vaquer, and Moné starts elbowing her, hits a gut buster, and the announcers even call attention that Vaquer has won the crowd over. And then the crowd starts chanting, fuck the Celtics. Then they move on. There's this dude in the crowd who's got a Celtic shirt on, and he's standing and he's calling attention to himself. And so this is just a kind of amplifying things. Then they move on to fuck the Red Sox. Meanwhile, the match is continuing, and Vaquer gets a boot up to stop the frog splash and hits this nasty looking dragon screw out of the corner. Moné gets the crossface, and then that's turned into a jackknife. The moneymaker gets blocked. She spins around and then finally hits the moneymaker, and it instantly goes for the crossface and gets the submission at 16 minutes and 48 seconds and is presented with both belts, and she's getting booed. And this actually worked out great for the spot that was about to come. In terms of the match, I thought that these two gelled pretty well, and I came away super impressed with Stephanie Vaquer. Like, I thought she was a great opponent for Mercedes in this, and they had to kind of overcome like this crowd that I think overall it kind of helped with what was going to happen afterward, but in the middle of the match, like, you sensed it was not even like they were just booing Mercedes. It was like they were just entertaining themselves for a portion of it. And I think when they got into the sports team stuff, I think it was less about the match and more about just getting their anti-Boston chants and going through them.
Sure. But I think it also calls to a feeling that this crowd had in wanting to treat Mercedes more as a heel. And I think it tells you about maybe an inauthenticity to her babyface character that I think a lot of people are continuing to find. You know, it was certainly evident in the Willow feud, and despite I think how they managed to repivot her back into a very successful babyface in the build-up to this match, I thought these sort of crowds, like a New York crowd, are very unpredictable, and when it kind of came down to it, they would rather see Mercedes Moné positioned as the heel here. It also calls to, I think, how creative a performance Stephanie Vaquer had here. I mean, I've seen her before, but I don't remember her looking this good. Like, she, to me, felt like one of the breakout stars of this show. Came in here and just, like, I would say in-ring outshine Mercedes Moné. who I thought Monet herself was excellent in this match. But Vakur, just like her offense looks so powerful, so precise. You know, she wrestles like a machine. And I was just like, I was blown away by her. And clearly I wasn't the only one, because this crowd, either through their dislike of Monet or just because they were so impressed by Vakur, were firmly on the side of somebody who made very minimal appearances on AEW television outside of, you know, video packages and like the one match I think she had against Lady Frost. So it made certainly for like a very unique and engaging atmosphere for the duration of this match. I would go as far as to say maybe the most engaged this crowd might have been up until the main event, or up until this point, I should say. I actually felt like this match was great, and it, you know, Mercedes again delivered on pay-per-view.
Yeah, I didn't have like a low expectation of this match, but it over delivered for me. I was very impressed with both of them. But to me, Stephanie Vakur was she was just excellent on this show. So
I also love the way the Moneymaker was used here as rather
it's like
than
a slam to set in the setup position now for the crossface.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than like just as like a sort of an awkward DDT in and of itself, it's used as more of a way to get her position opponent into position for the bank statement, which I much prefer.
Just needs a name. So as Monet did a great job of really selling like the fact of winning these two titles and like really putting over like the win as well. And the crowd,
like, and giving, I would say before that, John, like holding the titles and almost giving like a, you know, like embracing the heel reaction from this crowd.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. And then you hear Dr. Britt Baker's music play. And at this point, it was like they have set the scene perfectly here for this, where this crowd goes nuts. Huge pop for Baker, who has not wrestled since September. And she just comes out and stands on the stage. Monet holds up the belts and she walks to the back. And I think that's all you needed to do here. This was a great spot. And I think the crowd reaction just amplified this this return, and putting that, like, she was going to get a babyface reaction anyway, but it was that much better that you had this sort of anti-Mercedes reaction, and then you get the big babyface star coming back.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how they position this. I mean, you look at a scene like this, and there's no other way than to present Britt Baker as the babyface and Mercedes as the clear heel in this feud. Now, does that mean their long-term plans are for Mercedes to be a heel, or is she like the type of chameleon, you know, she can be a babyface, she can be a heel, depending on the opponent, like we saw with Willow and before she bounced back to being a babyface for this particular program? I don't know. By this point, I feel like the crowd has told you enough that you should probably think about just making her a permanent heel. You know, I'm looking forward to the feud. It's going to be, I think, the type of feud in this women's division that could actually elevate the division into you know, something more than just the occasional two matches for event, you
know? Is this big enough to warrant the second ever tooth and nail cinematic match in her dental office?
I'd be curious to see Mercedes do one of those.
I would not, but that's an option out there. Then we got the announcement of a Wrestle Dynasty for next January. And second from the top, it's the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship match between Jon Moxley and Tetsuya Naito, with Jim Ross on commentary and Moxley coming out in a New Japan jacket.
Oh, yeah. One of those.
What
jackets
does this mean? Yes. Red Shoes is the referee. And we get the explanation made very clear. It is New Japan rules, and therefore it could change by DQ or countout. So I thought that was
titles change hands by DQ or countout. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. They basically never do it, but it is technically a rule there. Okay. So Moxley is mocking him early on with the Tranquilo pose and sends Naito onto the desk. Naito spits at him, and Moxley hits a pile driver, and they're trading slaps. Mox gets shoved off the top to the floor, and Naito hits this ugly-looking spear by the timekeeper's area, where it just looked like everyone got knocked over here. They did not have a whole lot of room to work with. So Naito takes the padding on the guardrail and starts using it as a weapon onto Moxley. He hits the Esperanza in the ring. Moxley's trying for a choke, but Naito gets out and hits his first Destino, then goes for another one, and it's countered with a paradigm shift. So both are down, and we get a big inside-out lariat from Moxley, hits the Death Rider. Naito kicks out. So Moxley thinks it's a three count, and this is our controversial count, where he corners Red Shoes, and the announcers are questioning, was it a three count or not? And was Red Shoes counting too slow here? Mm-hmm. And Moxie then gets a chair, and Excalibur has to remind everyone that the title can change hands here by DQ, so this would not be a good idea for Moxley to use this. So Red Shoes kicks the chair away, and the crowd boos this spot. And Naito counters into this awful-looking Destino, and they kind of are just getting back onto the same page here. Naito hits his own, like, brainbuster Death Rider, and then follows with a Destino to win in 17 minutes and 4 seconds. And Taz laments, "I still think Moxley beat him with that cover earlier on." So that was your the title has gone back to New Japan. Match had its moments, but overall, I was pretty disappointed with this.
To me, this was the most disappointing match on the show. You know, on a show where I think up and down the card, you have some of the best talents in professional wrestling today. For your semi-main event with like one of the most prestigious championships in the world, I expected certainly a lot more. This
is a very anticlimactic title change, and just not anywhere near a Jon Moxley level pay-per-view match, especially second from the top on a show like this. It was just, it had a really rough ending, and I just did not sense like the fire at all out of Naito in this one. It was
they had
a much better match in Chicago than this, much, much better.
I thought it was on its way, you know, towards like a pretty, like, you know, what hopefully would have been a good finish. But this finish was totally fucked up. And I don't know who fucked up there. You know, like you get the sense that there was just miscommunication and somebody must have forgotten a particular way into their series of counters in the end. Or maybe there was like an injury that we at this point right after the show don't know about. But it was kind of fucked up. And I think also in this match, you got to see some very clear limitations in Tetsuya Naito's body, but there's still enough charisma and star power to carry him through.
Well, he's got 9 matches coming up in this G1.
God, poor guy.
That's why I'm not necessarily rooting for Tanahashi to be in this tournament at this age. And it's a question of like Ishii too. Like, I mean, yeah, these guys have like an Ishii, especially like they just pull off these miracles time after time, but there is a certain clock on all of these guys, and it's going to be, it's that many more. It's 2 additional matches this summer. Like, I don't think a Tanahashi should be doing the G1. Maybe you squeeze one more out of Ishii, but I mean, it's going to be a struggle for some of these guys. Like a Naito is getting to that stage too.
Yeah, New Japan is in a tough position right now where they're in a very clear transitional period between their new generation and their outgoing older generation, and they unfortunately still need to rely on the star power of the old generation in order to sell.
They're still the stars to a lot of their fan base. Like the current generation, like the next generation of stars aren't quite there yet, and it's still like this, like it's still the Tanahashi Naito excluding Okada era.
It was supposed to be Okada, and they lost him. So, like, he really, when you really think about all of this, it was a huge, huge, huge blow to that company in more ways than I think you know we realize. Osprey as well, you know, of course. So, unfortunately, a match like this didn't make New Japan look great coming out of the show when your champion and also like your other biggest star in Tanahashi on this event are very much on their way out. But you know, Tsuji had a match on this, but like guys like Umino, Narita, they're not big enough stars to maybe justify these sort of matches yet. Hopefully next year that'll be different.
Well, we go to the main event, Swerve Strickland and Will Ospreay for the AEW Championship. And Ospreay's theme is preceded with a montage of clips mixing in Hayabusa and Ospreay back and forth. And then when his music plays, this place goes insane. And he comes out, he's got a Hayabusa-inspired mask on, and he is dedicating this match to his grandmother who passed away earlier this week. So he comes out, great entrance, and then out comes rapper Jim Jones to introduce Swerve. And
did you ever expect the Hayabusa highlight reel to be followed by Dipset?
I mean, they go together so naturally that I figured it was about time. What I was not expecting though was Jim Ross to give us an update on Jim Jones as he went to this was not on camera, so this man was probably, thank God no one saw this. Jim Ross saw this, and he explains that Jim Jones tried to hop the guardrail to go to his seat, and I just saw Jim Jones fall right on his ass.
Oh, oh no.
I wish we had seen a replay of this, but it seems like he took a tumble trying to get over the guardrail. Mm. This crowd was red hot before the bell even rang, and they're chanting AEW, and they would do it throughout the match at different points. And the crowd is just on their feet as they start off at a great pace. They're both dodging one another, going for counters and head kicks. And Ospreay climbs onto the top of the guardrail and is knocked off. Both end up on the top, and Ospreay hits a Rana off of the guardrail. So Swerve comes back. He's working on the back, tries for a short arm scissors, and Ospreay catches him with a Styles Clash for a two count. And they show Daniel Garcia seated way up. He obviously waited late. He could not get a great ticket, so he had to sit in the up in the balcony. They battle on the top. Swerve hits an angle slam off of the top turnbuckle. And at one point, like, the crowd is pretty animated, and you just hear Jim Ross, "Get this guy behind us another beer, would you?" And Taz is like, "Yeah, maybe you could get a muzzle." Goddamn wrestling fans cheering and screaming.
I mean, we couldn't hear. They must have been saying something pretty, like,
they must have been really aggravating, because how many people have been screaming behind these announcers, like Jim Ross, for 50 years? And this one was, "Just get this guy another beer, would you?" So Oscutter gets missed on the edge of the apron, and then he rolls to the floor, avoiding a Swerve stomp. So Swerve just turns on the top and leaps into the air for a Swerve stomp that lands on the Spanish desk. This was nuts. So he continues. There's a springboard cutter by Ospreay into the Oscutter for a two count, and he goes for the hidden blade, and Swerve gets his forearms up to block it. So Swerve sidesteps another Oscutter, tries to snap the arm, and then Will hits the Stormbreaker. Huge near fall for this. And they cut to the back, and there is MJF watching the match, thinking, "Man, I should have entered this Owen Hart tournament."
Oh, he had a bigger fish to fry in Hetchicero.
Yeah. Ospreay then calls for the Tiger Driver 91, but it gets countered. And Swerve hits his own hidden blade.
He literally called for it. He's like,
Tiger Driver
91.
Yeah, took too long. We would have gotten there ourselves. Will, the Swerve stomp is missed, and then there's a hidden blade by Will. Swerve ducks, and he takes out Paul Turner, so he's out. There's another hidden blade by Ospreay, but the ref is down, so Don Callis shows up with a screwdriver, and he passes it, and Ospreay's conflicted. He doesn't know if he should use the screwdriver or not. So Prince Nana shoves Don Callis, who sells this like he was hit by a tornado. And the announcers explain, "Prince Nana is not a strong man. I think Don Callis is overselling it." But Ospreay grabs Nana, and he is about to stab him with the screwdriver. But he decides to toss away the screwdriver, and he rolls into the ring right into a house call, followed by the Swerve stomp. When Aubrey runs in and Ospreay kicks out, place goes wild. He snaps the arm, hits another house call, and yet Ospreay kicks out one more time. So Ospreay is almost out on his feet. He collapses in the arms of Swerve and is hit with one more house call, followed by the big pressure, and Swerve wins in 27 minutes and 5 seconds. Afterward, like, this was almost played up like you would get, like, right after a championship fight, where the champion comes over and he has words for the challenger, and Ospreay is devastated while Swerve is on top of the world, and Kyle Fletcher is out to console Ospreay, and Jim Ross says, "I just hope we are lucky enough to see a rematch one day." Excellent, excellent match. Match of the show, easily for me.
Yes, yes. On a show that had a lot of very good wrestling on it. I mean, when you talk about big pressure, like, these two had the weight of the world on their shoulders to deliver a match of unbelievable quality that could main event a show, perhaps containing, like, the deepest combined roster any wrestling show has ever had. And I thought they didn't only just, like, deliver a great physical contest with, like, great looking sequences and great execution of all their moves. They did it in, like, a really well-constructed narrative, you know, with some very great near falls. I think this is the type of booking that helps cement Swerve as a legitimate champion in audiences' eyes. And really not just in storyline, but, like, in real world perception. Like, he needed a match like this that is a match of the year contender to continue to remind audiences that he is one of the best in-ring performers of the entire world. Now possibly responsible for what might be another match of the year contender or even winner, you know, by the end of this. We'll see about that. This was Swerve performing at his best. But for Will Ospreay, I mean, it's incredibly rare that you have a talent that is so over, so unbelievably good, you can choose to delay his championship win because it's no risk. Like, he can win the title now, as a lot of people I think might have actually wanted for tonight. But like, him winning the championship a year from now is only like making maybe like the audience sort of salivate for the thing that they want that much more, because he's such a sure thing. There's really no risk of like missing the timing with Will Ospreay because he's that consistent. So he continues to, at this point, cement a legacy where he's, to me, not just seen as like the greatest wrestler of the year, not just the greatest wrestler of the generation, but you can now make an argument very convincingly that he might be the best in-ring performer of all time. And as good as his in-ring is, it's the charisma, it's the promo, it's the storytelling that I think are like new wrinkles to his game that we're starting to see right now during this AEW run. Great, great main event too. I think one of the shows of the year that we'll be talking about by the end.
Yeah, by the end of this show, I thought it was a very good show. I don't know if it was at the level of the prior two that I thought were legit like show of the year contenders, and maybe this will be. I thought this main event was terrific. This was like an unbelievable main event overall. I would say that was the match of the show to me, followed by I thought Danielson and Shingo, Zach and Orange, and Mercedes and Stephanie Vaquer. Like I would add those two, the Mystico Lucha Brothers match with LIJ on the Zero Hour. Like, this was a very good show. One quick update: Beyond Wrestling has posted a update stating Leo Rush suffered an injury during tonight's ladder match and will no longer be able to compete on their card this Thursday in Worcester, and we are looking for a suitable replacement. So that was conveyed there by Beyond Wrestling.
Yeah, so those are some of our thoughts. Now let's open it up to all of you guys in the Post Wrestling Cafe, which is our Patreon, postwrestlingcafe.com, where you get a bunch of bonus shows throughout the week, including Rewind to SmackDown, Collision Course, our MCU reviews, our retro wrestling reviews. At some point over the next month, John, you and I will be reviewing WrestleMania 40, Behind the Curtain, that documentary. And also, it's the beginning of G1 season, which means coverage of every single G1 event, and we'll be not just doing it by ourselves, but with a lot of our friends and colleagues and people who review New Japan Pro Wrestling on a regular basis, like the next caller coming up right now, Bruce Lord. Welcome to the Forbidden Door.
Evening, guys. Yes, it is almost G1 season, but that's obviously not why I'm calling in. I do very much agree with most of your thoughts about the event overall, and certainly the main event. Fantastic main event. I'm wearing a Hayabusa shirt today, so I was happy to see the tribute there. I did find a little bit of the callous theatrics at the end to be a little much and distracting a little bit from just the incredible purity and intensity of the match. But you kind of knew that
it
was
made
coming.
For a great near fall, though, didn't it?
It did. It did. You thought you were getting the slightly fucked finish, and you didn't. So yeah, I can absolutely take that. I agree. I don't know that this was quite on the level of the other two preceding Forbidden Doors. But I will say that, you know, for a lot of the concern about like, oh my God, they just keep adding more and more matches to this thing, I found it really breezed quite by. You know, there's been a couple of AEW pay-per-views that have just felt long. This was not one of them, I did not think. You know, nothing really seemed to go longer than it needed to. Really, for me, the kind of the thread through this was a pretty kind of unpredictable and somewhat wacky crowd. You know, like Red Shoes was completely over, but Shingo wasn't, which was just kind of strange and bizarre to say. I will say, to the point about the Naito match, you know, for folks who have not been keeping up with New Japan, Naito matches like this are kind of the reason why Karen Peterson and myself on the New Japan shows are saying, my God, we need to have that younger generation built up in the eyes of the crowd to the point that they can start headlining shows as soon as possible, because there's only so much left, you know, in Naito's knees at this point, and it's not much. Speaking of crowd reactions, really what I wanted to call in to highlight here were the reactions that you guys talked about that both Takeshita and Vaquer got. You know, I'm already seeing a whole lot of, oh, you know, Tony has to sign Vaquera Talk, and I don't know that that's either politically or personally feasible if you sort of know the backstory there. I will say that I was really...
I don't care to elaborate.
Oh, yeah. This is to do with some... Basically, her ex, who is was a contracted, I think, I apologize. I don't remember if he was CMLL or AAA, but Quachero was convicted of attempted murder of him. And various people, including Roosh, have sort of been campaigning or petitioning for him to, you know, be on parole or be let out of prison or whatever it is. So I think I've been keeping an eye on it. I don't think she has been booked on any of the matches, or excuse me, on any of the cards that Roosh has been on. I have to assume for that reason there. So there is some unpleasantness in the background there. But yeah, you know, I was, as somebody who has really gotten on board with her over the last year and a half or whatever it's been for the New Japan Strong shows, I was really happy to see that. I think she got over really organically with this crowd. Like, you're right, there was certainly a kind of, okay, we're going to, you know, just, you know, boo Mercedes and kind of go into business for ourselves for a little bit with all the Boston stuff. But I do think a large portion of this was respect for the work that Vaquera puts in. There's a real intensity, directness, and grit to her work. Her matches are always laid out in this really intense and logical sort of way. I never have a bad time watching her matches, and I thought she got over wonderfully here. So that was nice to see, regardless of what, you know, the future is for, if she stays in CML or whatever it happens to be. And yeah, and as to the Takeshita thing, exactly what you guys were saying. They need to have a plan in place right now for what is going to be done with him as soon as we get to the end of August and the G1 is finished. You know, we know that I think a lot of the time Tony does book people to lose a lot in AEW before a push. I think we could see this happening with Takeshita, but you know, the crowd was ready for it today. Obviously it wasn't going to happen with the G1, but they're hungry for it, and you got to give it to them sooner rather than later, I think, with Takeshita.
Do you think there's any risk of maybe that sort of, you know, want from the audience dissipating with him being away from the company for 2 months?
I think if you time it right, if you actually time a return, you know, with something in mind, if you have him returning specifically to target or challenge a very, very credible high level opponent that he can convincingly defeat, because he has had high profile matches with main eventers and he's lost every single one of them. Right. So you need to be bringing him back in with a serious program, whether it's for a title or not, with somebody that the crowd does view as a main eventer, and you need to have him go over, I would say.
Last thing I want to ask you about, Bruce, is what's your reaction to Wrestle Dynasty?
I mean, we've talked before about the possibility of, oh, you know, New Japan fans saying, why isn't the Forbidden Door shows ever happening in Japan? I think, you know, obviously there's the roster there to book it. I still, you know, maybe Karen would be the better person to say as to the degree to which CMLL and AEW stars are viewed as possible, you know, draws or whatever it might be in Japan. I like this more than the kind of, like, you know, half-assed sort of, you know, oh, collaborative show with Noah or All Japan, where you know it's going to be like a very, very political sort of one. I think with the fact that you're dealing with companies that are in such different physical territories, you can give, you know, more substantive singles matches on a card like this, as we saw today. You know, sure, fine, AEW won most of them, but I do think that this is it's a welcome alternative to the sorts of completely within Japan cross promotional shows that we've been seeing so far. Will they be able to get, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of what the regular Wrestle Kingdom show does? I don't know about that. It'll obviously depend on what they are willing to book ahead of time and who these companies are willing to send over for it. But at least I think it also shows that this collaboration is one that I think AEW and New Japan are probably going to want to kind of double down on, especially in light of everything happening with Noah and the WWE right now as well.
Mm. You would think it opens a path for an Okada and an Ospreay to go back to Japan.
Yeah, and the timing would almost be about right at that point. I think, you know, you didn't want to do too much with them in terms of having a crossover. You know, they're, what dream match is there for them to have at this point? But there could be something that could be worked out by that point. And at that point, yeah, absence might have made the heart grow a little bit fonder with those two.
Sure. Thank you so much, Bruce. We can hear more of your thoughts along with Karen Peterson, W.H. Park, Eric Marcotte, Kate from Montreal, John Pollock, myself, for G1 coverage starting later this month in the Post Wrestling Cafe.
Looking forward to it. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Bruce. Let's go up next to Jordan from the Bronx. Is this Jordan?
Hello, yeah, Jordan. This is Jordan. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hey, can you hear me? Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome, awesome. Yeah, so I was at the show. I'm actually still driving back home. I don't live in the Bronx anymore, but the show was very fun in person. This was one of those shows where they had like 15 matches, but they didn't go more than 20 minutes each. So I think that the change from the old shows to now made it a little bit easier to digest.
Mm-hmm.
The Naito match was kind of disappointing, I'll say, because you can clearly see he's not who he used to be. Hold on. Mm-hmm. I think I have to mute something because I'm getting feedback. Hold on. I'm sorry, guys. All right. So one of the things about the Naito match was kind of difficult was you know that he's really good, but you also know that those knees are kind of messed up. I can explain what happened with the Mercedes match, though, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
The match was awesome. Like, Stephanie Procure was really good. I think the issue was we in the crowd, we kind of really wanted to boo Mercedes. Just her character isn't very babyface friendly. A lot of her offense isn't very babyface friendly. So a lot of the match was an appreciation of Stephanie. But Stephanie's kind of hard to chant. Procure is kind of hard to pronounce. So it's just easier to just rail on Boston. Honestly, we're all New Yorkers. It's just
very
kind of
logical
what we do.
Outcome. Yes.
Yeah. We're just jerks that way. But that match was really fun. And like you guys said earlier, I think the surprise of Britt Baker coming out really kind of set it off. And that's going to be a really fun match whenever they get to it.
Mm. I wanted to hear from you, first of all, Jordan, like on maybe the sort of reaction to the announcement of Hechicero versus MJF, and also what the sort of, I don't know, the overall feeling towards Max's booking on the show was.
I don't know. I'm a fan of Hechicero. I think in general, the crowd didn't really know who he was. So it was just more so of people really just wanted to see MJF on the show, and I think that's kind of just all it was. He did great, and I think that a lot of people kind of started warming up to him during the match, but everyone kind of just was waiting for MJF to get the win and kind of just get their cheers in. That was pretty much that. I think that I understand politically why they couldn't do Rush on that card with the AAA thing and everything with CMLL, but it was disappointing that we didn't get Rush MJF, but I think Hechicero definitely stepped up and kind of made a statement as far as having people kind of know who he is going forward. Mm-hmm. Hopefully he gets a little bit more of recognition than he did in the show.
Cool. Jordan, I'm going to let you go, but thank you very much for the call. Your mic is a little bit rustling, and if you're driving, I do feel bad about maybe taking up too much of your time. But thank you for calling us here.
Thank you, Jordan.
On our post show. Hey, let's go up next to Hanzi. Hey, Hanzi, welcome.
Was good. I, with the cold, I thought the main event delivered. It was a match that I was most looking forward to. It was probably the best built match. I wouldn't say it was like the best pay-per-view they've had, but I mean, it's still a strong show. I mean, I think a bad AEW show is still like not a bad. I mean, like, you know, lower than usual. I still think it's a pretty decent thing. I mean, I think for future, I might have to skip the pre-shows and maybe watch them later on. Maybe else, because the thing is, I get it, because the matches, some of the matches are important. And I did want to see the trios match. In the end, whatever, right? And I just think sometimes I'm an old man now, right? So I get exhausted by the time the main event comes on. So that's just my own thing. I'm not, because people in the chat were all arguing about the complaining about the length after a good main event. Listen, the main event was amazing. It's probably one of my favorite matches, whatever. Yeah, there's some matches that I just didn't think need to be on there. I don't think the the Jericho match needed to be on, and I would have said the Naito and Moxley match didn't need to be on, but that was for the World Heavyweight title, whatever. It just wasn't that good. I just didn't think it was that great. So those two matches that were kind of weak. I'm looking forward to Britt Baker being back. I'm glad that she got cheered. You know, I know she's like, you know, kind of like an online villain and stuff, right? I thought that was really good. I'm looking forward to that feud. I agree with you. I want to see Stephanie Vaquera there. I was more impressed with her. I like Tony and Mina. I didn't think it wasn't the best match, but I thought it was overall pretty good. I enjoyed the claim and that match too. My question before I go, it'll be two questions, then I'll just hop off. Do you guys, I brought up to Kate and John Cena yesterday. I don't know if Mercedes was just fooling around or just talking shit, but she talks about how she has creative control. So with the whole WCW documentary coming up, whatever, and all that kind of stuff, right? Do you foresee any, like, you know, like squabbles going on with like creative control? And then the other question, and I'll leave you guys with this. You got to talk. We're talking about like New Japan needing to push more people, like, because, you know, Naito's are kind of like running out of course, and Tanahashi's kind of like, you know, losing steam a little bit too. I got to ask you guys, why do you think Zack Sabre Jr. doesn't get more elevated? Because I think this guy kills it with every match. I think he's great on the microphone. I think he's such a great character. And I it's not Tony Khan's fault or anything like that. It's New Japan. I just think that he doesn't ever really get elevated to the next level. And I just think he's someone you should be building your company around. I think that guy could be a future main eventer. I just look at this guy and I'm like, this guy... He doesn't have a bad match, and I wasn't looking forward to the Orange Cassidy and Zack Sabre match, and I thought this was like one of the better matches with Zack Sabre in it. So I'll leave you guys with that, and thank you for the recap, guys. Peace out.
Thanks, Hadi. Any thoughts, Sean?
I mean, with Zack, I mean, he's somebody that's, you know, he's been in a very, like, he's in a spot where he's, I think certainly you could go a lot further with Zack. I think when you're talking about Naito, though, I think like they are looking at, like, who is going to be that native Japanese star that is going to be somebody that as well can, like, replicate the, like, merch sales that a Naito brings to things. I mean, Zack is he's untested in that high of a spotlight in New Japan. But I think you're almost like setting the story for this year's G1, that this is the year for Zack to really make a run for the G1. And I think when you're looking at the people that, like, Zack feels like somebody that is, you know, going to be there for the long haul. He's certainly someone that I think you should have in that mix. But being that top foreigner, it's just they've never gone that far with him before.
I'd love to see them try to see how not just the Japanese audience would react, but like even an international audience would react to having like Zack be pushed as hard as a Kenny Omega, or like, you know, even an AJ Styles, or certainly even a Jay White. You know, like if they made him a headliner of the Tokyo Dome, would it attract enough attention internationally to justify like giving him sort of like the Gaijin, top Gaijin spot? Maybe to me the untested thing would be like, certainly his promo is outstanding, and I don't think, like, I'm surprised like we didn't get more of it in this build-up to Forbidden Door, because I just think he's so funny and just so witty, but the in-ring style is not you know, the most fan friendly to somebody just getting into it, at least not in the way that a Kenny Omega or an AJ Styles style would be. You can argue whether or not he's more fan-friendly than Jay White, I suppose. But I would at least love to see New Japan Pro Wrestling like try with him and at least give him a shot at it. Thank you very much, Hansi, for your call. Did you have another question? I forget. About Mercedes and like creative control. I didn't hear the clip.
So I didn't either.
So I can't really comment on that. Okay. Some super chats here. Sorry, I forgot that earlier, everybody. But let's go to Felipe from Chile, who sends 2,500 Chilean pesos, John. Really happy for Vaquera. I know her from her start here in Chile. I hope for a great future for her. Put eyes on Catalina also, formerly of NXT. A big hug. Thank you, Felipe.
Thanks, Felipe.
Nice to hear from you. And yeah, your country woman had a great showing tonight. Let's go to Jared Taylor, who sends $5 to say, appreciate you guys staying up late to review the show. Double Shots and Rewind Away have been great lately. Shout out to Collision Course. Thank you, Jared. Yeah. We've been reviewing Who killed WCW? Yeah, it's already dead. Now we have to find out who killed it. We've been reviewing every single episode on the Double Shot. And as we mentioned earlier, John and I will return at some point this month to review the WrestleMania documentary.
That's right. And Rewind Away this month, we're going to be doing WrestleMania 9 this week. And then later in July, the Invasion pay-per-view from 2001. Those are on tap.
Yeah. Do you want to end things off with a few pieces of written feedback?
Okay, we go to Benjamin. The main event was unreal. A great show as per usual. It makes me wish a lot of the stories leading into these matches were fuller with more stakes heading into these great shows. Monet and Stephanie Vaquer killed it. The pop for Britt Baker was amazing. So glad she's back. Storm and Shirakawa killed it. Danielson and Shingo killed it. And that ladder match was insane. Learning Tree and Cobb against Joe Shibata and Hook was okay. Long Island crowd was rough on Jericho, chanting, please retire. I like the finish of the match. Hook using the Judas effect. Hook is also seemingly letting things breathe a bit more between moves. I felt like the MJF match was a little inconsequential. I thought that they were going to try to bookend the show somehow with him. I'm glad I was wrong because that main event was unreal. I liked Red Shoes reffing the Naito Moxley match. Great to hear JR on the desk. Glad he was able to come call the matches given his recent health scares. I also have to say Excalibur, Taz, and McGinnis should be the permanent trio on Dynamite.
I love Tony Schiavone. I think he adds, like, you know, sort of like a certain nostalgia to, like, you know, hearing a wrestling event called on Turner. But I don't disagree in saying I think I might even prefer this team to that. Let's go to Brian from New Jersey, lastly, who has the final word tonight. Brian in New Jersey says, happy Canada Day and happy wrestling. Another really good night for AEW on pay-per-view. That main event just ended as I wrote this, and I'm still buzzing from it. Incredible match. Very happy with the result. I also thought Danielson versus Shingo was outstanding. I also really like Sabre versus Orange. I hope Mina Shirakawa isn't a stranger to AEW moving forward, as I really liked her as part of the act with Toni Storm, who is firing on all cylinders with her act, and Mariah May. I also hope Stephanie Vaquer makes more appearances in the future. She outclassed and out-luchaed Mercedes Moné. No shocker in the result, and now Moné is all set for likely Wembley against Dr. Britt Baker, who will decimate her on the mic leading up to it. I'm also not shocked by Naito winning back the IWGP World Heavyweight title, but I think that guy is such a shell of his former self. I thought Moxley held up his end as usual.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for your feedback to the show. A late one here as we go through or went through all of Forbidden Door, but we are going to do it all again tomorrow night on Rewind to Raw, so tune in. And again, it is July the 1st, so it's a brand new month at the Post Wrestling Cafe. As we mentioned, coming up this week, we have got Rewind Away coming your way, and then Rewind to SmackDown every single Friday night, Collision Course each Saturday night. And then we are also going to be covering the G1 beginning July the 20th. And there will be podcasts covering every single G1 show from July 20th through August 18th. $6 gets you in the door and gets you all the bonus audio questions. And yes, we will be doing Rewind Away as well, covering the Invasion pay-per-view. Quite the intriguing show from July of 2001. All of that and more. Plus, the X-Men rewatches with W.H. Park and Rich Fan. They just have one up going through the Wolverine with Karen Peterson talking about what was true to Japanese culture and what did they take liberties on?
Yes, yes. And coming up this week, you'll never guess who the guest is.
I will guess. Here to talk about Logan will be the one and only Brandon from New Jersey.
Oh, how's that going to go? I can only imagine.
It'll probably be a train wreck, but that's what you will get on MCU Later, coming up later this Thursday.
I want to give a special shout out to Martin Bushby, who just completed a 12-hour charity stream over at youtube.com/@poisonranapod for a charity known as MC8, raising £800 in support. I don't know how that man pulls out 12 hours of engaging interviews just by being himself, but he
did it. Iron Man.
Yeah, so congratulations to Martin.
All right. Well, thank you to everyone for tuning in. We'll be back on Monday after Raw, and that completes our look at Forbidden Door.
Dickie Bird here from Chopped Tees. Our summer super sale is now on.
Grab up to 25% off selected tees and hats from Post Wrestling, WrestleNomics, The Lapsed Fan, Poison Rana, and more. Shipping is free and fast almost everywhere in the world. Just go to chopped-tees.com and grab a deal before the sale ends at midnight, July 7th.